Hello, everyone. My name is Kayla.
And I'm Steph, and welcome to the Witchstory Podcast.
Here we talk about all things witchy, including historic witch trials, tales, and folklore. So grab a tea, sit back, and enjoy the episode.
Today's episode, we'll be talking about a famous witch from 18th century England named Mary Bateman, who committed several counts of theft and even murder. This woman was so addicted to crime that under her occupation, she is listed as a con artist. And the sensation of her trial had people paying to see her dead body in a museum long after she was dead. And stay tuned, because after Mary's trial, we have a little bit of a special on the history of Samhain, which will be at the end of the month. And we'll also talk about how you can celebrate it.
Thank you, Steph. And I'll start with our story today. Mary Bateman was born Mary Harker in Aisenby in the north of Yorkshire in 1768. Her parents were farmers, and she learned to read and write, but from age 13, she began working as a servant. Around the age of 20, she moved to York and worked as a dressmaker. Now, her early life, every source you see is a little bit different, but apparently she was involved in a burglary, and so she fled to Leeds. For the next few years, she worked there again as a dressmaker and began also on the side working as a fortune teller or a wise woman. She started dating a man named John Bateman, and after a three-week courtship, they married in 1792. John Bateman was a wheelwright, and apparently he would regret his decision on marrying Mary. In the early years of their marriage, apparently she kept committing little crimes such as robberies and petty theft, but she still kept her job as a fortune teller or a witch. She gave people advice using special powders and potions, read their futures, claimed to cure their ailments, but people started noticing that anytime Mary got really close to people, they often got sick or died. In 1803, two of Mary's friends, the Quaker sisters, who ran a draper shop, died suspiciously alongside their mother. Apparently, they had taken a medication that was prescribed by Mary and perhaps made by Mary, but in the end, no charges were actually filed against Mary because she told the neighbors and the witnesses that they actually died of the plague. And I think she made it seem that she was either genuinely trying to help them or that they died of the plague and it completely was not her fault. So there probably was numerous instances similar to this where people came to her and trusted her for advice, and she probably got them really ill or killed them, but, you know, she got off the hook. She also did this really weird thing where she joined this prophetess, Joanna Southcott, and attended meetings, and apparently part of the sect, she created this hoax in Leeds called the Prophet Hen. And basically what happened was apparently this hen was laying eggs, and on the eggs it says Christ is coming, like written on the eggs, but it came straight off the hen. So people were like, oh wow, a hen laid an egg with this message saying Christ is coming. But apparently three of these eggs from Bateman were found to, like, she obviously took the eggs out and wrote on them using acid and reinserted them back up the hen for the hen to lay, so that people will be like, oh wow, a hen just laid this Christ is coming egg. So I thought that was very weird. And then some other crimes, she apparently, there was a big fire in Leeds, I think, and she was begging for money and, you know, food and stuff for the victims of the fire, and said that she was working to donate all these, you know, presents and gifts and food items and money, but she kept all of it for herself. So a lot of these crimes, I don't think she was actually found guilty of. She was actually found guilty many years later, when a couple named William and Rebecca Perigo of Bramley, Leeds, went to her for advice because they trusted her healing witchcraft. And Rebecca had these chest pains and claimed to see supernatural beings. And she told her doctor this. And the doctor suggested that she actually might have been under a spell and she should seek help from a witch like Mary. So Mary was then hired to help this couple out. For 5 months in 1808, she milked this couple from their money and stole their personal items as well. Mary ended up receiving what she called a special honey from one of her quote-unquote helpers. I'm reading this direct quote out. And she made it into a pudding for the Perigos to eat. William only ate a little bit of the pudding because he said it tasted really, really bad. But Rebecca ate all of hers. And because of this pudding that they ate, William ended up being really sick from it. And Rebecca died. But William actually kept taking Mary's advice for another year because he didn't believe that it was because of her that his wife passed away. But then he finally realized that he was being scammed. And when he called the police ended up finding a number of items from their household and the poison that was used to kill Rebecca in Mary's possession. So she was super guilty. Her trial for the murder of Rebecca Perigo started on Friday, March 17th, 1809 at York Castle. Her trial lasted 11 hours, and during this trial, she claimed that she was 22 weeks pregnant. And back then, if you were pregnant, you were unable to be hanged or executed because, you know, there was another life in you that was probably innocent, and this was a religious country. And so the judge decided that they would get the sheriff to gather a bunch of women to assess this claim, and 12 married women were sworn into the jury, and they also had to conduct a physical examination of Mary to make sure she was pregnant. And of course, Mary being the con artist that she was, she actually ended up not even being pregnant, and so she was allowed to be executed. We do know from an account in 1867 by William Knipe that Bateman had a daughter and an infant child with her, an infant child in the prison and a daughter still at home. And apparently she mailed her wedding ring back to her husband to give to the daughter. Mary was found guilty of fraud and murder. So in this case, she wasn't hung as a witch. She was hung as a murderer. And on March 20th, 1809, she was hung in front of a crowd of 5,000 people alongside two other men guilty of their own charges. So it's very interesting that she believed that she had supernatural powers. She used these powers as a fortune teller or soothsayer. Soothsayer actually means truth or reality seeker, and she wasn't guilty of those crimes. It was mostly the murder she was found guilty of. So it seems for the time period, even because a doctor actually referred somebody to go to her, that it was okay to be a witch. Okay, so now that you've heard the crazy story of her life and death, it kind of kept getting worse or crazier after. So you know how when you have a really popular TV show, there's merch sold? Well, basically, her trial was so popular that parts of her body ended up being sold as souvenirs. So some strips of her skin were tanned into leather and sold as these little magical charms to ward off evil spirits. And the governor of Ripon Prison, R-I-P-O-N prison, actually collected the tip of her tongue And then from the library of Mexborough House, two books were actually covered and bound in her skin. These books were Sir John Cheke's Hurt of Sedition, How Grievous It Is to a Commonwealth from 1569, and Richard Braithwaite's Arcadian Princess from 1635. So these were old books too, and they just chose to bind them with her skin. And the books actually went missing in the 19th century, believe it or not.
Well, of course.
And then people
stole them in honor of her.
Yeah. And then her skeleton was also on display at the Leeds Medical Museum until 2015, where it was then moved to the university. So it is still there, but people used to pay to view her skeleton. Like, there was a whole thing where every day people would pay a certain amount of money and just come look at it. Talk about not resting in peace. And then I also found that one of her descendants, because as I said, she had the children. So she actually does have descendants. And one of them appeared on a show called The People Detective, where they laser scanned her face in order to reconstruct her appearance. So I thought that was pretty interesting, even though, you know, there's only so much reconstructing you can do because of muscle and bone and tissue and all that. But yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. But I actually chose to talk about Mary during Halloween spooky Samhain season, because normally we talk about people who were victimized as a witch, etc., etc. You can't prove that they were a witch, but they were gone on trial anyways and just confessed. And there's always, did they do it? Were they a witch or not? But I think in this case, you know, she was a kleptomaniac. She assaulted people. She's, you know, murdered people. So I do think that she was very guilty. She was a very bad person.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. But it is weird though, because like maybe, because you know how you were saying that she was basically a klepto, which indeed she was. Like, if somebody's saying that she's addicted to crime, then for certain that's true. But people that are like that, they often don't really do it on purpose. They feel the need that they have to. It's, I consider that kind of like a mental disorder in a way. So like, yes, she was still a pretty bad person, especially because she murdered somebody. But I also feel like this part of herself most likely drove her crazy too.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I think she was of such interest to a lot of people back then, and even now, like psychologists, etc., that are looking into why people commit crimes. I think she's an interesting topic because, you know, sometimes murderers are only murderers and kleptos are only kleptos and arsonists are only arsonists, but she just seemed to be
both.
Everything, yeah.
All together. My goodness, yeah. There has to be a root to something there, but that's also something that freaks me out too. Like, I can't really watch those shows. Like, what's that show called?
Mindhunter.
Mindhunter. Thank you. Yeah. I can't watch it because the more and more, like, I feel that we're understanding them, it's like, I feel like it's easier to relate to them. And that scares me the most. I don't want to understand them, but I do at the same time because it's so interesting. But it's just weird because a lot of them can maybe be very like similar to you or other people, and then one day they just snap. I don't know, it makes me uncomfortable to understand that much. I don't want to.
I'm the opposite. I really like looking at that and seeing, and I don't want to say empathizing with a killer, but seeing like where, like what happened to them that strayed them off the path of, you know, being quote unquote normal and not killing people. I actually love looking at the psychology behind that, but I can very much separate myself and know that, no, I'm not a killer, but you know, it only takes,
yeah.
you know, just like something that might've happened in your life and the whole, like, is it nature or nurture and stuff? And you see some people, like, they grew up in such horrible environments and you're like, okay, no wonder they turned out like mm-hmm. this. But some people, you know, start off as kids and you're like, well, what happened to them. But yeah, I don't know.
I think it's when they start to become romanticized, that's when I start to get really uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, totally. It's gross. That's why I'm just like, why are these body parts wanting to be seen? It's no.
That's a pretty crazy trial. That's intense.
Yeah.
Just with the whole, like, why would they bind books with her skin? Like, I get, like, it could have been for profit, but, like, how, like, what possessed you to think of doing something like that? I don't get it. But that's just gross. Just nasty. And, like, it wasn't even technically Victorian times yet, right? People had an obsession with the macabre, and they'd love the sight of death, and they'd wear like beetles as accessories and different things like that. But I never thought that they would actually like doing something like that or consider doing something like that. That's just gross.
I mean, actually, I think it was near the Victorian era, because if she was hanged in 1809, and this all started a bit after she was killed, then, you know, Victorian era is what, 1830? So this would have been, yeah, this would have been around the Victorian era.
I thought it was interesting that, like, part of her body was sold as magical charms to ward off evil spirits, because I think she was an evil person. So why would you use that?
Well, you know the saying, like, fight fire with fire?
Okay, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's so true, because, like, when you think about that, like, how they sold like body parts and different things like that, it reminds me of how people used to sell pieces of supposed saints, like, to bring luck or miracles or to ward off evil. It's like the same thing, except the saint is supposed to be a good person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah,
that is it for our awful witch of the week. Now we're going to talk about Samhain, one of our favorite holidays. Samhain takes place in the Northern Hemisphere from October 31st to November 1st, or in the Southern Hemisphere from April 30th to May 1st. The festival is known to be one of the fire festivals in the Wheel of the Year, and this one marks the halfway point between the autumn equinox and the winter solstice. This also marked the end of the year and the beginning of a new year, welcoming the darker half of the year. In ancient times, the celebration could have also been celebrated on an October full moon.
The word Samhain can be seen mentioned in Irish texts dating back to at least the 9th century, but also was observed earlier than this. And it was also observed by the Scottish, Welsh, and Manx peoples. Some etymologists have tried to figure out where the word Samhain came from, and there's a lot of thought that it might mean either end of summer or summer fun, but this can all be seen as just hypotheses. And for the ancient Celts, November 1st actually used to mark the first day of their new year. And we also know that around this time, multiple other cultures recognized this embracing of the coming darkness in their own way as a connection to the underworld, and they had their own days that commemorated the dead, which ended up merging and being celebrated on Samhain, which we'll talk a little bit about later. But today, Samhain can predominantly be seen celebrated by Celtic polytheists, Celtic neo-pagans, pagans, and Wiccans.
This day is also believed to be where the veil is at its thinnest, no longer fully separating the living realm from the dead, as well as the fairy realm. Most celebrations were taking place at outdoor communal spaces, which included hilltops, caves, or the center of ancient communities. In the Middle Ages, torches or small bonfires were also lit and left on the edges of properties to ward off fairies and witches. Some of these locations were thought to be doorways to the other realms. Here, celebrations with bonfires and sacrifices or offerings would be made that would relate to their needs that they would need through the winter months. Offerings were also left at the edge of their villages by their door or inside on the table for ancestors and the she, which means the fairy folk. The bonfire and its stones would have been used for divination as well, and Samhain was considered a good time to tell fortunes or see the future. it was tradition for people to let their own fires die and bring back a torch from the communal bonfire to relight the hearth. This was taken as a measure of good luck and completion of the harvest, hoping to provide protection for the coming winter months. Around the bonfire, many folktales would be shared that were said to have taken place on Samhain, such as the stories of how Finn McCool defeated Aelin, a fire being that would destroy villages every Samhain, the headless horseman hunting for his head every Samhain, or the White Lady that may have also been known as Lady Gwyn or Wen. This White Lady seems similar to a banshee. However, she's obviously dressed in white, sometimes evil and sometimes good. But every time she is either a representation of death or that death may be coming or has already occurred in the place that she would inhabit or be seen. Her soul is known to be lost, some believe her to be a victim of murder. But on Samhain night, she is known to chase people or appear on mass burial sites. Any story to do with fairies or witches around the bonfire is obviously acceptable as long as it scares you a little bit. I did find a poem while I was reading, and it's called Calangaeaf. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it is originally Welsh. And it translates to the White Lady. So, a tailless black sow and a white lady without a head. May the tailless black sow snatch the hindmost, a tailless black sow on winter's eve, thieves coming along knitting stockings. Most of this has been sourced from Llewellyn's Sabbat Essentials, and it's the book on Samhain. There has been a lot of debate about this book on whether or not it can be resourceful, because I think it's a really good compilation of history and practices, and uses actually really great sources. So I do recommend all of Llewellyn's Sabbat Essential books, just because they can be really helpful, especially if you're a beginner in witchcraft or Wicca.
We're not sponsored. Okay, so now let's talk about dressing up, perhaps. Like, why do people dress up for Halloween?
So basically, it was seen recorded as early as the 16th century from Ireland, Scotland, Isle of Man, and Wales, where some people pretended to be the Aeshi, the souls of the dead, and would dress up like them and go door to door asking for offerings, oftentimes singing in exchange for food or cake. So if you've ever have heard of a soul cake, this is where it originates from. And the whole act of dressing up was called guising or manning and would be seen as protection from the actual souls of the dead. Oftentimes, perhaps an animal head would be worn. And some people even believe that this was so that the fairies or the dead would not be able to recognize you if you left your house dressed as one of them, because as Steph said, this is when the veil was the thinnest. So if there's spirits walking around, you wouldn't want them to think that you're human. You would want them to think that you're one of them. And also there was pranks that were played on this evening by mortal folks who got away with it because they would blame it on the fairies or the dead. So that's where the whole dressing up for Halloween came from.
And I suppose that would also be the tricks for the trick-or-treating. But Steph, do you want to talk about where pumpkins and the jack-o'-lanterns came from?
Yeah, so jack-o'-lanterns were not always glowing pumpkins on porch stoops or what you see today, but they actually started out as carved turnips that were carried on strings with charcoal embers inside of them, or sometimes they were also left at the door or at the edge of properties, but they were mostly carried by people for protection or basically to go along with the story where jack-o'-lantern originated from. So it's actually a Christian folktale. Old Jack was a blacksmith, quote unquote, so evil that heaven and hell refused him, and he was forced to roam the earth in purgatory and would return every Samhain night, roaming the woods with nothing but a turnip lamp for guidance. I find that hilarious. Sorry. Over time, the pumpkins were more common and grown more often, so they have been used instead of turnips, and probably for a better smell too. Lit pumpkins were also used to light the way for spirits and ancestors. So it wasn't just to represent old Jack, but also to serve some guidance and serve as like a welcome light for ancestors and other little ghosties to come back home.
Ghosties. So now that we know where the name Jack-o'-lantern came from, let's talk about where the name Halloween came from, because why was it changed from Samhain? And you can pretty much blame the Catholic Church. So in the Catholic calendar, November 1st became All Saints Day and the 2nd of November became All Souls Day. The All Saints Day celebration was called All Hallows or All Hallowmas from the Middle English word All Hallowmas, A-L-H-O-L-O-W-M-E-S-S-E, meaning All Saints Day. And the night before it, the traditional night of Samhain in the Celtic region began to be called All Hallows Eve and eventually Halloween. But as I mentioned before, a lot of cultures and traditions from around the world were already celebrating a Day of the Dead. So it's interesting to me that everyone ended up picking Samhain basically to become Halloween. And it's funny because I was actually telling Steph about this a few days ago, but it depends culture to culture. I know in Poland specifically, where my father's from, that on the All Saints, All Souls Day, that overnight, you would traditionally put out an extra meal for dinner at your dining table and you'd leave it there overnight for your ancestors who come visit in the night to have a meal with you. And you'd put it out front the next morning and you'd just be like, thank you for coming, come back again next year, please don't haunt us for a year, we'll see you again next November. So I kind of like that.
That's really nice. It's really sweet.
But unfortunately, it wasn't like, there was no Halloween or dressing up or anything there. So you kind of missed out on that aspect. But that's just one tradition. Let's talk about how we celebrate Samhain, or what you can do to celebrate Samhain if this is your first time celebrating.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so I think it's always a good idea to go for a nature walk and walk through a graveyard and visit ancestors if those graves are close to you. And if they are, just leave some flowers or even just anything that they loved when they were alive. It could even be food, even though animals would probably get to it, but I feel like it's still a really nice gesture. This is an amazing time for divination and scrying, and divination also through tarot. Also a great time for necromancy. Obviously you have to practice that with caution if you do. People say that this is the safest time to practice with a Ouija board, but I will never do that. So, yeah, again, use caution. But if you're going to have a seance and you want to connect with people on the other side, just because this is a time where we believe the veil to be at its thinnest, this would be the best time. And I guess it would be the safest because it would be easier to contact the people that you want to get in contact with. What I mean is that if you try to do a seance or use a Ouija board at any other time of the year, and you're trying really hard to contact this person, something else might come, because I feel like they were called back at the wrong time or like forced to talk to you. Whereas at this time of year, it's not like they are being extremely forced. Like it's the correct time to do it, is what I mean. But yeah, this is also an amazing time to cast spells, make your little potions and tinctures, wear black to commemorate your ancestors and in memorial of them and of the holiday itself. Wear costumes to scare away unwanted spirits. What else do you do, Kayla?
Obviously, the traditional bonfire, I love to have that. Telling ghost stories around it or just watching horror movies, like this is the time for spookies. Another thing I love doing at this time of the year, and that I think is really important because as we talked about in the celebrations, this was a time where the days are getting really cold, you're preparing for winter, a lot of people went door to door asking for food. So I think a really nice thing to do at this time would be to donate to the less fortunate, whether that's food or warm clothing or whatever you can really give. When I say warm clothing, like we live in Canada, so temperatures get to like minus 40 degrees Celsius. So if you have any spare mittens and stuff to give, I always love doing that. And Steph, in our notes, I can see you have in caps locks, have a feast. Yes, that is really important to me as well.
Having feasts, like, I don't know, hosting something like that is literally my favorite thing to do. Just have a big roast. If you're vegetarian, roast a squash. If you're not, I don't know, roast a chicken or a turkey or something. Yeah, and just have your friends over and cook everything with love and maybe even say a little bit of like a chant or a prayer over your food and serve it to the people that you care about the most.
And that actually kind of goes with another point I have, which is this is a time that I would bring everything in from my garden to propagate or harvest so that we'd have everything for the winter prepared or for the new year. So just a friendly reminder, if you live in the great white north, to bring all your plants in. It's getting really cold.
Now comes the time for preparation for winter. So you start like pickling things to make sure you can preserve it or make sure you have enough wood for the fires and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And then my last point that I would do normally at this time is remember your loved ones who have passed. Go visit them if they're in a cemetery near you, do a cemetery walk. I love doing that around this time because it just seems so perfect with the fall leaves and the foggy weather.
Oh, we didn't talk about the altar, really.
Oh, right.
I think, yeah, altar is so...
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say quickly that for every time I talk about doing an altar, it's always up to you and your practice and what feels best for you. So around this time, always you would think about ancestors and harvest. So you'd probably want to dedicate something to them. But if there is a goddess or god or deity that you predominantly worship, also try to make it, you know, cater it to them as well. Your practice, and there's no right or wrong to this. I personally would probably put some offering to an ancestor to make sure that they would receive it at this time. Steph, I know you had some good points about decorating an altar, whether that's with dried leaves or not skeletons, don't put human remains on your altar because that's illegal, but like, I don't know, bones or like figurative things. Any harvested fruits or vegetables, anything for your ancestors, mulled wine, cider, mead. And once again, when you're doing this, you don't have to get like the most expensive or nicest things or anything. Just make it affordable. And also just don't culturally appropriate anything. Just make sure whatever you're getting is properly sourced and ethical and sustainable. For example, sage is currently going endangered because everyone's using it. So maybe grow your own at this time and propagate your own instead of buying it.
Because there are, I'm sure, plenty of people who listen or just people that I know that collect crystals or stones. The best stones for this time of year are obsidian and amber. And the best herbs are rosemary, garlic, cinnamon, mint, myrrh, and nutmeg. And then you can also use those for incense to burn as well. I did source those from Harmony Nice in her book Wicca. But I do like actually use this in real life too. And they're my favorites. So she names all those and more. I just chose my favorite ones from there. And cinnamon and myrrh and nutmeg and rosemary are literally my favorite smells. I love them so much. Did we mention carve a pumpkin?
No, we did not mention.
One of the most important ones too. So yeah, carve a pumpkin or turnip. Or this is one of my favorites, leave candles in windowsills to guide the way for your ancestors and show them that they're welcome at your house. And of course, like you used to do, leave them food. I think that's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So that concludes our podcast today on Mary Bateman and Samhain. If you're celebrating, then happy spooky season and blessed Samhain. And we would just like to give a big thank you to everybody once again for tuning into our episode. If you'd like to send us a message, feel free to email us at witchstorypodcast@gmail.com. Please don't forget to rate and subscribe. It helps us out a lot. And follow us on social media at witchstorypod. We hope you tune back in again next week for another episode. Bye, everyone.